A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast.
So last week on the show, we heard from the incredible author, motivational speaker, Alison Edgar.
Yes.
In the episode, you talked about building confidence, especially in neurodiverse children. You talked about the education system and if it's outdated. And Alison shared her secret to getting what you want.
Yeah, I mean, as podcast goes, that was packed full of information.
Knowledge bombs.
It was. And Alison's, you know, there's one thing you know, she's been delivering that stuff for a long time and with so impactful. And it's really great having someone on the show that just sees things the way I do. I really get uncomfortable when people aren't positive, and she just smashes the positivity bombs all over the place. And
yeah. I mean, if you haven't listened to that episode, definitely go listen. But not before you've listened to this week's episode. You sat down a couple of days ago with Edward Keelan, a.k.a. the Dyslexic Investor. So Edward is the principal investor at Octopus Ventures. In March 2020, he published his first blog as the Dyslexic Investor. He spoke candidly about his experience with dyslexia, and he believes that neurodiversity is a different rather than inferior set of skills, which I guess is really in line with the values of the podcast. His first post went viral on LinkedIn and would later go on to get republished by the British Dyslexia Association website.
It was quite incredible that he'd done that just because he felt he needed to express himself. And as a result, he's now very well recognised as a speaker and someone that really stands for it. And you just don't know if you express your feelings or your experiences. It's amazing how people can pick up on that. And he's become so well known as a result of that. And he done it just to originally get his thoughts down on paper. It wasn't to get somewhere, but it was really great speaking to him about how his investments work and how he uses his dyslexic gift to power that through.
So in the episode, you first off talk about what venture capital is and what it does. Then you talk about if dyslexics really are discriminated against by their employers, which I imagine is fascinating to hear his take on that. Edward also shares the story about the post that went viral on LinkedIn. Yep. And apparently you guys share anecdotes on your worst best man speeches.
Do you know what? I don't want to spoil that. I think the best thing we could do is take a listen. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Do you want to tell us a bit about what you do, and you just quickly, like your name, where you work, what you do?
Okay. I'm Edward Keelan. I'm a venture capitalist, which sounds quite grand when I say it like that. But yeah, I work in venture capital, which means I invest in small companies. So we invest in little startups. So things that you might have heard of, things like Zoopla, Kazoo, Secret Escapes.
Patch.
Yes.
I say that because I love Patch.
And yeah, we did Depop, that sort of thing. So I work for, the company I work for is a company called Octopus Ventures.
Yeah, amazing. And you're known as the Dyslexic Investor.
I wrote a blog. I put this blog together. I'm not entirely sure why. And I labelled it the dyslexic investor.
Yeah.
I don't think I would be as grand as to say that I was, you know, that's some sort of title that I give myself. In fact, what was it was quite interesting about the whole dyslexic investor is that one of my a kind of good contact of mine, he said, why do you have to be the dyslexic investor? Why can't you just be an investor that's that has dyslexia? Like, why does it have to be labelled in such a way?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this has backfired on me straight away. So yeah, I just thought it was an interesting title that garnished a bit of a few eyeballs onto it. So, but yeah, I'm an investor that has dyslexia.
I actually always wanted to be a venture capitalist.
Okay.
And ironically, that's why I always, when people go, what do you want to do when you get older? Which they still ask me now at 38, which is nice. I always say I want to be a venture capitalist. So now I can actually ask someone what one is. So do you want to, for the listeners, explain what a venture capitalist is in case someone doesn't know?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different types of venture capitalists. So, you know, as with all these things, we like to put things in boxes and give them labels and stuff. But ultimately what it means is we take other people's money, other people's funds, people like yourself, or institutional money, so like pension funds and that sort of thing. And then we look for interesting and exciting, smaller, growing companies that we think are going to become big. And hopefully the idea is we invest some of that money that we've raised from these people, invest it into the small company, and it goes really well. And then we sell it in however many years, 3 to 5 years, and everyone's happy. So Octopus Ventures, we've got really good records, so we're really fortunate, an amazing team of people. We manage about £2 billion worth of funds. Wow. And as I say, we've done some pretty good household names, like the latest one being, I think the latest big exit was Depop to Etsy, but also Cazoo on the New York Stock Exchange, but all those sorts of companies they're investing into much, much sooner. But as I say, there's different types of venture capitalists. So we ought to have a whole span of it where you've got like the absolute kind of rock stars, which are like our consumer pod. They're doing all those kind of crazy, cool brands that you've heard of that I've talked about.
Mm.
You've then got like the deep tech team. They're doing, I don't know, flying robots and mind control and all this, you know, things that you can't even imagine. Mm. And we've got then a health tech team that are doing things like looking at some really cool fertility companies and new ways of kind of delivering health, this sort of thing. And then I'm in the most boring team of all of those, which is B2B software. So the team that I work in, it's not boring. It's still super interesting. You become like an overnight expert in so many different areas. So like, you know, my companies range from companies that do things like ID checking for like when you're applying for mortgages or loans and this sort of thing, all the way through to software that's helping improve the quality of our hospitals. But it's all with that sort of B2B technology focus to it. So yeah, a whole range of different things.
So how did you get into B2B software? How did you get into?
I just, you know, when you were seven and you wanted to be a venture capitalist, I was like, I just really want to invest in B2B technology. That's all I want to do.
You've achieved your goals.
Just achieved it. Yeah. Do you know, it's a funny thing. I think that I left university. All I wanted to do is be an entrepreneur. That's all I've kind of ever wanted to do is be an entrepreneur. My dad's an entrepreneur. My mum ran her own business. You know, I grew up around it. I couldn't understand why anybody would want to do anything but run their own business. Just couldn't get it into my head. But I also wanted to go to university because I like education. I like learning. So that was something that I wanted to do. And it was never quite the right time to make the jump into being an entrepreneur. So close, so many times. And then my friend worked in Octopus, and it was much smaller. I've been at Octopus for 13 years. And when I joined Octopus, you know, there was less than 100 people. There's 2,000 now or something like that. It's massive. And it's just an awesome company. That's the truth of it. And I just kind of ended up in this company, Octopus. And, you know, Simon, the CEO, has just created the most awesome company, which meant I could never leave. Because every time I thought I wanted to, there'd be something new, something different around the corner. And yeah, I started there actually on sort of the fundraising side. So talking to people, doing fundraising. I think that I got on well with people. I worked really hard. That's the truth of it. And I was always interested in getting on the investment side. So I'd had a friend and I was talking to him about careers, and he'd mentioned venture capitalists. And I thought, that sounds really interesting. Yeah. I'd quite like to do that. And then all of a sudden I sort of found myself at Octopus, and I was like, okay, I'll work really hard and I'll try and get over to the investment teams. And eventually, somebody took a bit of a chance on me, Mario, who was leading a division at the time. And at the time, we were investing into sport, and I'm massive into my sport. So the first ever investment I did was into Sheffield Wednesday Football Club. Actually, I don't know if that's confidential. Probably be all right now. It was about a decade ago. the funny thing about that is that I'm a Sheffield Wednesday fan. So I was like, how good is this? You know, the first investment I ever made was into the football team I supported. So we did that. We did sport for a bit. I started off as an administrator, you know, just absolutely doing the filing and all sorts of stuff like that. And then worked my way up. And then I was part of the kind of renewables gold rush, as it was. But I like people and I like entrepreneurs, and I really wanted to work with entrepreneurs and businesses rather than bits of metal like you do with solar plants. And so there was kind of a team that was doing that, and actually I won't bore you with the details, but that team has kind of manifested itself into this kind of B2B software focused team, which is actually, you know, where I'd want to invest. That's kind of where I think that my skills lay, where my head lays. As I said, I'm not kind of deep into those sort of specific areas like robotics or biotech or something like that. And B2B software, you've got sort of, we have numbers to hold on to, and I can imagine the businesses and how they were going to use that technology and how it's going to expand and this sort of thing.
So if you want to be an entrepreneur, and you've kind of end up supporting entrepreneurs, I suppose, really, with your investments. But it's quite exciting for me because you're the first person we've had on the podcast that comes from a corporate world, which is interesting because I've always wondered how the corporate world kind of embrace neurodiversity. And you saying the fact that you love working at your company makes me wonder what they do to encourage neurodiversity, or how you personally have felt about working in a corporation about that. So what is it they do, or you feel that they do, that support your neurodiversity?
Yeah, I mean, Octopus is a special place. I could glare about it. If I give you examples, you know, when that blog that you read that I wrote, that's on LinkedIn, that got shared within my company. And we have an award, a kind of monthly award at the company. Yeah. It's aptly named the Grand Tentacle.
Clever.
Yeah, I know. I don't know where they came up with it. And actually, you know, I won the, you know, monthly award, the Grand Tentacle, for that blog and the fact that I'd shared it and I'd been that open. And actually from there, there was this kind of neurodiversity kind of committee that started up, where people with all sorts of things, not just dyslexia but ADHD, you know, just come together, talk about it a bit. But I think it's also that, just that kind of allowing you to be vulnerable. And our chief executive, he sends weekly emails, you know, and a lot of his emails are actually about his own vulnerabilities around, I don't know what that might be, anxiety or worry or things that he's struggling with, or things his family's struggling with. He's very open about it. So I think that leads to a place where, you know, you don't worry about talking about it because other people are being open. But I think one thing's, you know, really interesting, I've seen a lot of companies, you know, I see many companies every day, and worked with probably hundreds of companies over the years. And what you realize is that culture truly does start at the top. You know, if you have, and it sounds a bit wishy-washy, and I'm always a bit like about these sorts of things, but it is true. If you have a very kind of aggressive, you know, harsh kind of authoritarian senior figure, that will come down to their management team, and that will go down into the people beneath them, and that will then come down to how they talk to people externally.
Yeah,
you know, someone like Octopus, right at the top, you've got someone that's saying, like, let's all be vulnerable, let's talk about our weaknesses, let's share lots of feedback about what we think we do right and wrong, etc. And that then kind of goes across everybody, and also how we treat people externally as well.
I mean, that's great to hear, because I find in the world we live in now, more companies want to talk about that stuff than actually do it. And when you speak to people, I have my family members that live in work in corporate environments, and they promote a lot about actually doing this, but when you work in it, it's not actually true. So it must be pretty amazing to work at a company that actually does embrace that. And like you say, I think myself, I always find that the person at the top really sets the tone for how the company goes. And I mean, it must be hard. Lots of people, like you say, 2,000 people is a lot of people in a company. So it must be good to be able to be vulnerable when you're used to it, but not necessarily everyone else is.
Yeah, and look, it's not, nothing is ever perfect. And Simon, the CEO, would admit that himself, I'm sure. But he's very goal orientated, just his natural. He's, you know, he's enthusiastic. He's you know, he's like that guy that gets up and does his Peloton at 4 a.m. and then does a full 16-hour day and forgets about sleep because that's just a waste of time sort of guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we, for example, like if he sees a problem, he's open to it. So we probably had a wellness problem, and whether we, I think all companies constantly should be thinking, and it's not a problem that you can ever fix. It's something you should continually evolve. Yeah. So, you know, a few years ago, it was becoming probably quite a big problem. And so he was like, I don't like this about our company. I don't want this to be it. So we've now got things like free mental health coaching. So if you've, you know, if you're going through a tough time at Octopus, you can go and see a counsellor, and that's all paid for. And you can do it. You do it on work time. You know, I had a run of, you know, a bit of a bad period at work where I was struggling with some of the investments I'd made. And so you could go, just go and talk to somebody. That's fine. You know, go and talk to that counsellor and have that. And that really helped me actually at the time. So I think that you have to make those proactive steps. You know, we've got really generous, you know, paternity pay, 6 months full pay, you know, when my second child was born, that sort of thing. But you can't just talk about it. You've actually got to put it into action. I say also Octopus is what they call a B Corp.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if you've heard of B Corps, but it's the idea is you're not just for the benefit of the shareholders, you're also for the benefit of the employees, environment, community. So you have a bigger range of stakeholders naturally, which puts you to a bigger standard.
Yeah, it's obviously a high pressure job picking the right companies to work with for you. And like you said, they give you that support. Do you think your dyslexia helps you with that, or you, is it more you as a person? Because a lot of people do say, you know, dyslexia, being good with people and situations, which is normally from a result from dyslexia, helps them. But there's also other people who go, I've speaking to a lot of people recently who with dyslexia, who turn around and go, well, I think that's just me, not really dyslexia. Do you think it plays a part in it?
Yeah, I mean, there's cause and effect, isn't there? It's something that I find this subject fascinating, is where people look at cause and effect. They're like, hey, it transpires that people with dyslexia are really robust.
Yeah.
And it's like, is that because they're dyslexic, or it's because, you know, at a young age they failed so much that they had, that actually the only successful dyslexics that got through that had to get used to failing and being robust. You know, that wasn't the dyslexia talking. That was just the fact that to get through it, you had to be used to failure.
Yeah.
If I look at my career and look at myself, I guess I've never worried about failure. You know, partly because I've had, you know, my parents, I'm very fortunate to have two very loving parents that wouldn't matter what I did, would love me kind of unconditionally. But also I think because, do you know what, I failed pretty much since, you know, the moment I started school.
Yeah.
So it never really bothered me. And I don't know, it puts it into context. My dad, there's one story that kind of, if I think about my investing career, I'm going to the finer detail, but basically I'd worked bloody hard for about 6 months doing crazy days, crazy, like, you know, 12, 16 hour days continuously for about 6 months. And then things started to go wrong. And I was like, not just about the fact that, you know, you've got investors' money, and I truly do care about the fact that this is other people's money. So if we lose the money, that's people's hard-earned money that they've worked really hard and they've trusted us to invest it. And so if things go wrong and you're losing it, it's galling, and I've had sleepless nights over it, no doubt. But I just remember there was one conversation that I had where I was like, I don't know, it's about 11 o'clock, getting the train from Waterloo, talking to my dad on the phone. I'm like, Dad, honestly, it's going terribly. You know, we've had some bad advice. It's made it all go wrong, et cetera. And then he said, like, are you on the train? I was like, oh, I'm on the train, Dad. He said, look around you. And he goes, no one gives a shit. And for some reason, that always put it in perspective for me.
Yeah.
It's like at the end of the day, you know, we are a small planet in a massive universe, and we're around for a fraction of a moment in the entire scheme of things. So, you know, and there's much worse things going on.
Well, they always say, I'm going to completely misquote this, but they say, when you're younger, you worry about what people think. When you get when you so when you're young, yeah, when you get in your 30s, you stop caring what people think, and then when you get older, you realize no one gave a shit about you anyway, or something like that. And it was so, it's so true. We sit there, and actually, ironically, and James was just talking before this, and said about how whenever we do something, we have in our head, if I put that out, it might be like this podcast, I will give it a 3 out of 10. But other people think it's a 10 out of 10, but we judge ourselves more harshly than the world judges us. And it's like I said to you before we started recording, I am on the season 2, I saw myself in the videos, and because of lockdown, I put on so much weight. And I remember going, oh my God, we can't send this out. I look awful. But to me, I look awful. But to everyone else watching, I look like Andrew. So they might have noticed I put on weight, but it's like we judge ourselves so harshly. And I think that's kind of like pretty much the message, isn't it? You know,
well, I always think that I take a bad photo. I'm like, oh, time's not photographed at all. And then like, I think my wife pointed out, it's like, no, that's just what you fucking look like. So I'm afraid that's just what your face is.
Yeah. Christina said, every time she takes a photo of me, it's a lovely photo. Every time I take a photo of it, it's awful. She's like, I think it's a man-woman thing. Women take better photos than men, and we just put up with it. But you were saying about all this support about the corporate environment. Do you think the corporate environment is set up for dyslexic people? Because there's a study recently released by EY saying that the corporate world is actually quite geared towards dyslexia now, or dyslexic people. What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it's a real tough one because I've worked at Octopus 13 years, and before that I worked at a small consultancy where I had a really good boss that's still a good friend of mine, Paul, and he was brilliant and understanding. So, you know, and then before that I started my career at Rolls Royce, which was truly dreadful and boring. So, you know, I'm not sure that I'm the best placed person to speak for kind of all corporates and environments. I think that the harder thing for dyslexics, actually, once you're in the corporate environment, if you're working hard and you're developing the right mechanisms, you can add a lot of value because, you know, what are we good at? Good at problem solving. We're good at seeing, I hate this term, but like the big picture very quickly, seeing how things fit together. And that's really useful. Mm. You know, that's really useful. If somebody says, okay, can you help me with this project? And straight away you can go, actually, I can see how this project works. You know, I can see how I can piece this together. You know, that last year, for example, the CEO of the Octopus Ventures team, Elliot, said, oh, could you look at work experience for us, Ed? And straight away, you know, in my head, I was like, the entire week's mapped out pretty much in the next 15 minutes in my head, because I can see how it all fits together really quickly and what would be good, what not. Obviously, you still listen to the rest of your team, and then they come up with even better ideas and you add to it, and you know what I mean? And then that improves it. I think the trouble for dyslexics is more getting into those jobs in the first place. You know, I'm lucky. It's a weird one. Am I lucky? Maybe if I'd never ended up in a good company like Octopus, I would have founded my own company, been a successful entrepreneur like you, and been even happier. Who knows?
Yeah.
But I am definitely lucky that I ended up in a place where somebody with my skill set could thrive, and it would be taken on positively. I think there'd be a lot of people that are looking for trying to get jobs in other companies where they just would never get the job. And I remember doing the kind of graduate rounds, you know, when I first finished university.
Yeah.
And you know, when I'd mentioned that I was dyslexic in interviews, I just wouldn't get callback. And I'm not saying this is probably a bad survey of one.
Yeah.
But in the back of my mind, I was like, I thought that interview went really well, and I can't understand why I didn't move forward. And so I thought, when I got the Rolls Royce interview, I was like, I'm not going to mention it. I'm not going to talk about it and see what happens.
Yeah.
And that was the job that I got as a graduate. So I think it's that access to jobs, I think, is the more difficult thing. Once you're in, you're probably all right.
Well, so last season we focused on should people tell their employer about dyslexia? And I think the overall reply was, it'd be great if you could, but most people, the majority of people, wouldn't be comfortable. And certainly the feedback we've got from all the listeners is that it's not something they would be comfortable doing, even though it's now more widely spoken about. It's a tough one, isn't it? And that's why you've got to change the conversation into the positive aspects of it. But how long will that take? Like, certainly, even if we do nothing but talk positively about it, we certainly won't be in our lifetime that that kind of change happens, because without people seeing the benefits, it's probably going to be quite hard to prove.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting. I mean, it's funny when I was joined Rolls Royce. Like, so I actually, you know, I managed to blag my way into Rolls Royce and getting a job there. And like within the first week, they sent us off to, I don't know what, I don't even know what a title was, some sort of HR, like learn about, you know, how to manage people or something, or I can't remember. And I remember her saying in this session, like very vividly, so if you've got a dyslexic in your team, you know, don't ask them to use a computer, just give them a hammer or something that they can deal with like that. And I was like, oh shit, what if I'm the dyslexic? And so
oh my God.
I remember my friend Karen just turning to me going, I'm going to say something, Karen, it's because I told Karen for whatever reason. I was like, don't worry about it, it's fine. It's like, that'll be a great anecdote. And it's things like that that I've had through all my life. I remember being in, even at an early age, being in like a bookshop and a guy coming to the counter and saying to the girl at the counter, you know, I'd like, I don't know, some book title that was no one could possibly spell, and she said, oh look, I'm dyslexic, can you write on a piece of paper? And his answer to her was, well, if you're dyslexic, what are you doing working in a bookshop? And those and I mean I confronted him I remember confronting him saying, look, I'm dyslexic, and that's just a horrible thing to say, and there's no need for it, and the
also
rest of it.
Not true.
It's not true. I mean, this was 20 years ago, as well. I mean, it was an old bloke. So
what's really funny though is I always say this to people, I'm amazing at reading. Reading out loud, no. But if I read a book on my own, I generally read it faster than most other people. Granted, I might have to reread lines over and over again, but the speed that I read is impressive. Again, me and James were talking earlier about reading. You know, they say if you have a word and you don't change the front and last letter, James asked me, can I read it? I'm amazing at doing that. I can still read it, and I probably read it faster than normal. But I said the words jump around anyway, so it doesn't really matter to me.
Make a lot of difference.
So it's actually...
Do you know what the truth is, though, about that? If you're being honest about it, and I remember at the time, as well as though I confronted the guy, I actually remember thinking, it's probably right, you know? You know what I mean? It's probably right. You mentioned it before, like around the imposter syndrome and dyslexia, and I think it's so funny because I go full circle with it. So first of all, I'm like, well, maybe a dyslexia shouldn't be doing this job, and you know, what am I doing? What have I got to offer for this team? And you know, I've managed to blag my way in, and da da da. But then I go full circle as well, and then I'm like, what happens if I'm not even dyslexic? What happens if dyslexia isn't even a thing, and they've made that up? You know, I don't know if you have these thoughts. I have these crazy ideas where I'm like, maybe I'm not even dyslexic, and actually this is just an excuse for me not being very good at remembering facts and names and things.
I'm very careful to not use dyslexia on my ADHD for a reason why I do something. And the more I've done this show, I'm doing it more, because now I know the reason why. Before, I didn't know why I'd done things, because I didn't know it was part of dyslexia. I've always known I'm dyslexic, but I didn't know things were part of dyslexia or ADHD. So if I ever done anything, I blamed myself. If it was wrong or I struggled with something, I was just like, oh, I just struggle with that. Like we were saying earlier about names, terrible with names.
Yeah.
But now I find myself going, oh, well, I'm dyslexic. That's why I'm terrible with names. But that really feels like an excuse to me, and it feels almost dirty to say that.
I mean, like,
so it's like when I sit there, I went to an organisational meeting to do with civil engineers, and my ADHD, it's like a absolute running, burning sensation down my legs and arms when I have to sit there too long. And when you do degrees in like engineering, you have to sit there for hours listening to complicated maths and stuff like that. And I haven't done that since university. And I sat there and I was watching it, and it just felt burning inside of me to move. And I had to force myself to sit there, because when I speak to people with ADHD, they're like, actually, you're actually quite relaxed. And I was like, you have no idea how hard I squeeze my feet together. If you look under the table now, I'm squeezing my feet together to keep still.
Do you think that's ADHD? I mean, I don't know as much about ADHD. I've got a good friend at work that has ADHD and suffers and things. But I don't know as much about it, despite the fact we've got this neurodiversity group that we do talk. But I struggle with the same thing. I've never been diagnosed with ADHD, and I wouldn't think I have it. But if I'm sat there and somebody is talking, the only thing that I can do to make me concentrate is doodle.
Yeah.
So, which comes across as really bloody rude. as well. And I'm like, you don't understand. If I sit here and I make pretty patterns on this page and I'm listening to you, I'll be fine. Mm. If you just make me sit there, my head is going to go all over the place.
So what I have is when, if I have this all the time, I go out with friends and we sit there and talk, and we might be talking about our lives, our business, our families. When we talk, the second you say something that interests me, my brain goes to work in processing it. So you might go, I love making pizzas, right? And then I think, well, why don't you turn it into a side business? And then I start thinking, well, if you're doing a mobile van, you're not paying for a place where you work. And then I go, and if you do it into this cool van, let's be good to market if you do this. And if you change this to this, and my brain, and before I know it, I'm listening to what you're saying and I think it's amazing. But my brain's gone so far off in another direction. And that's why when sometimes you speak to people, in fact, Christina pulls me up on this all the time. We're having a conversation like we are now, and she will say something, and then the conversation will continue for 5 minutes. I can repeat every word she's saying, but then I will say something else. Why have you changed the subject? But I haven't. My brain's just taken what we just talked about 5 minutes ago and taken it somewhere else. So she'll say, oh, I think we should do this because we've been doing an office fit out. I think we should do this. And I go all the way down. And then 5 minutes later, I'm like, oh, remind me, I need to speak to this guy about doing this. And it would be nothing about the office, but I would have gone all the way down to the end and then come back and got to something I need reminding about.
I mean, it's funny you should say that about the business bit. So I do that all the time. So especially with companies, which is great if you're, you know, sitting on the board of a company and, you know, you can try and share ideas and things. But I do it, as you say, all the time. Like we would literally just beforehand, I got here a bit early, trying to be on time.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. and because I like my food, I saw Park Plaza is opposite. Just opposite, and I'm like, I bet they do a good breakfast. I'm gonna go in there for a breakfast. Yeah. And I go in there to get a breakfast, and I'm like, in all fairness, I was wearing a hoodie, I probably looked a bit like a tramp and all the rest of it. I'm not the most well presented. Mm. And I said, Can I get some breakfast? He said, it's for residents only. I'm just like, I'll pay, you know, 15 quid for one of your breakfasts. You're turning down that, you're turning down that. And then all of a sudden I'm walking out, I'm like, you know what, if it was me, I'd have signs at the Tube that, I'm reorganising his business for him.
That's what I do.
Yeah, it's a terrible habit.
But isn't it fun? Actually, it's quite funny. A lot of people like spending time with me because I'd sit there and they basically float business ideas with them. And I will sit there and just go, why are you doing that? And then, because the other thing is, it's almost like, I can't control what I say when I hear something stupid. Oh, yes, I'm doing this. Why? Why are you doing that? That's not a good idea. Why don't you do this? Oh, well, that's genius. Why didn't we think that? And it's like, I can't help it. I find people get to that point eventually, but it's just like I jump straight there.
Yeah, I mean, the nature of my job is obviously that working with lots of different companies, which is, as I said, probably the best thing, working with entrepreneurs and working with lots of different companies. It's just so fortunate, so interesting, you know. There's a kind of a saying that I'd heard, which is like, you know, once you've got a job as a venture capitalist, what do you do next? And it's like more venture capital because people just stay with it. There is no other thing because it is so interesting. But it doesn't mean, you know, a lot of friends come to me and say, oh, I've got a business, can I have an idea? And one thing I always say to them is, look, I'm more than happy to look at the company. But, you know, I say, number one, I'm often wrong. Like, I'll give you an opinion. So I famously said that Octopus Energy, so spoke to our chief executive even, and famously said that I thought Octopus Energy, our energy supply business that we started and grew, was a bad idea and we shouldn't do it. I think that got last valued at about £4 billion. So I make a lot of calls completely wrong. But I said, what I will do is I'll give you my honest, you know, I'll give an honest critique, because I think when people start businesses, a lot of the time what happens is they ask their friends and family, you know, I'm going to start a line of, I don't know, cat slippers or something crazy like that. And they're, oh, that's a brilliant idea. Yeah, people will love that. Whereas, you know, I come in and say, look, if you ask me for your opinion, I will give it a very honest one, whether it'll work or not.
It's funny you say that, because I find families and friends are normally the most unsupportive people. I'll say this, and my mum listens to this podcast, so she's probably going to kill me for this. But my parents are completely unsupportive. But if anything, that's been the best thing, because I think if they were supportive, I wouldn't have driven myself. So, for instance, my mum once said to all, I've got three brothers, said, oh, none of you are like your dad and would run your own business. Now, she will listen to this and go, I never said that. And she did. She said that you are not them sort of people. And at the time, I was starting two businesses, and I remember sitting there thinking, no, I've got to prove her wrong. And that's what's really great, because the amount of times she says, no, you can't do that.
But it's good to, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it goes to show that, like, the whole nature-nurture debate and, you know, what's right and what's wrong with parenting and all the rest of it, I think it's a really difficult one. And I mean, I you know, I'm a dad of three kids, and I honestly am clueless when it comes to parenting. I thought I'd be, you know, I assumed I'd be an amazing dad. So I made that assumption, and I have got not a Scooby-Doo what I'm doing. I never know whether to, you know, give them a carrot or a stick. I never know whether to shout at them or cuddle them. You know, it transpires that, you know, playing with kids is good fun for about 15 minutes. For 5 hours, it's really dull. I was thinking, you know, when you watch those Pampers adverts and the mum's playing peekaboo with the baby, yeah, and you know, they're all smiling and cute. I'm like, yeah, that is cute for 5 minutes. Now do it for 5 hours, you get pretty dull. That's when you go on your phone. But, you know, I had the most, you know, I couldn't have had more supportive parents in a way. And that hasn't stopped me from being hardworking. I mean, it sort of, you know, having super supportive parents have huge amounts of money. So if I wanted money, I'd go and work for it. You know, I was, I did Taekwondo as it happened. So I'm a bit into the martial arts as well. And I failed my black belt twice. I don't remember it. You know, my parents encouraged me to keep going at it. You know, like, you know, you finish something. And I think as I put in the blog, like, the only reason I got my GCSEs was because my mum sort of literally went into the school. And the school found out I'm dyslexic. What do? They put you in bottom set everything, because that's the best thing for a dyslexic. Okay, that's great. Apart from now, I can't get my GCSEs. So I can't get to A-levels and I can't get to university. And so, you know, my mum, being who she is, sort of strodes into school and is just like, you're not putting him in bottom set. He's not stupid. You know, put him up a set. And, you know, that's the kind of level of supportive parent that I had. And she can be quite fierce if she wants, she's not, but she can be if she wants to be, like, really want to cross her. But I think what was interesting about it is that I think even for them, when I got my, I remember getting my A-level results, and I got two B's and a C in my A-levels, which, you know, for a kid that barely scraped through his GCSEs, that was pretty good. And I was disappointed with a C. I predicted a B, so I was more upset about the fact I got a C. But I remember saying to my, you know, telling my mum that, and I think she was a bit surprised. You know, so even though that she'd been so supportive and believed in me and all the rest of it, she was still maybe a little bit surprised that I'd managed to sort of scrape those grades. I mean, I know they're not straight A's and amazing A levels, but, you know, for me at the time, from a kid that was in bottom set everything to get three A levels was a pretty big thing. The interesting one, because I think that, as I say, my parents were incredibly supportive and never, you know, couldn't wish for better parents. But, you know, they'd been, I think, would have been pushed on them by the school, which was like, you know, Edward's only really going to achieve this. You know, this would be amazing if he got slightly, if he could read and write a little bit, sort of thing. And then it was only when I did a placement year at university, and I went and lived in San Francisco for, you know, typical dyslexic thing. You know, everyone else is doing the kind of normal graduate placement stuff. I'm like, I want to go to America. And so and there was like, there's no jobs in America. I'm going to find a job in America. Like, wrote to anybody I could possibly think of. You know, again, like, it's just the sort of silly thing dyslexics do, because they couldn't see these, you know, the big picture of it. And so then I went, lived in America, and I met a good friend of mine, who's, you know, one of my very best friends in the world, Pete, who had a baby yesterday. So congratulations. Welcome to the world, Pete. Maddie. He is the cleverest person I know, no doubt about it. He won the Stanford scholarship. He's a Stanford postdoc, Cambridge masters or whatever. He's a molecular chemist. And and I said to him, you know, I remember walking down, we were walking on the beach in San Francisco. He says, oh, so what are you going to do with your degree? And I was like, I'm really going to, you know, I'm hoping if I work hard, I'll scrape a 2-1. And Pete was like, bullshit. Work hard and get first. He's like, I've known loads of clever people, way cleverer than them. You can get a first if you want to. And I'm like, Pete, I can't. I'm, you know, dyslexic. And he's like, that's just an excuse. He's like, if you want to get a first, you can go and do it. You just got to figure out how. And he was like the first person. And I mean, you know, we were very close, spent a lot of time together. He was the first person who ever really went, why not get a first?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, why not really push yourself and see what you can do?
Well, I think when you really understand dyslexia, I think we become obsessive about things anyway. So if we really want to do something, you can achieve that. And we had Rory on in season two, and academically, the stuff he achieved was unbelievable. We're in the veterinary field, which is so hard. My brother's ex-girlfriend done that as a course. And this is one of the cleverest people I've ever met. And she struggled so much with that. So I think it's when you really have a passion about saying, I think you can really do it.
I think this, that understanding as well about dyslexia. So I have convinced myself I am definitely dyslexic, despite the, you know, I've done three kind of tests that from the ages of like 9, 16 and, you know, 35. So I'm definitely dyslexic, but I'm still like, I've probably convinced myself now. And, you know, one thing that came about doing it and understanding that I was dyslexic in my own mind, not just on paper, but in my own mind was that I realized that if I really try to understand something, I could get to grips with it. If I didn't, if I wasn't just trying to learn it off the paper and just parrot fashion it back, but to understand it to a point where I could teach it back to somebody in a way they would understand it, it's like, oh, actually, I really get this. And people are saying that I'm actually quite a good teacher of it. And you know, when I did my master's, that was when that really, really hit home. Well, there was that, and sorry, we're doing a tangent now. We're going off on one of your tangents you were talking about. There's that, and you know, I've got the fear of God of a whiteboard. If I went to hell, I would be stood up in front of a room full of intelligent people with a whiteboard marker, trying to write down what I was saying. Mm. You know, I hate it. But one thing I really found was interesting was I did something called the Petacucha. I don't know if you've ever done that.
No, what is it?
I'm so sure Petacucha, it sounds really kind of grand, but it's not at all. It's the idea is that you've got 6 minutes to do a presentation, but you've got it on 20 slides, and each slide is one picture that rotates every 30 seconds. Does that make sense? So like you choose a subject, like why did you want to start a podcast, or you know, what makes a good structural engineer, or you know, how do you start a pizza restaurant, whatever the topic might be, and say, right, you're going to present that as a Petacucha, which is this presentation of 20 slides rolling every 30 seconds. Make sense now?
Yeah,
got me.
I'm visualizing,
and I can see it in you already. And so like the dyslexic, this is amazing, this thing doing a Petacucha. If you want to know if you're dyslexic, do a Petacucha, because the dyslexic brain is perfect for it. The dyslexic brain just builds the entire presentation in their head within seconds.
Yeah.
And I remember doing the masters and we were asked to do this on, I think it was something like what motivates us or something like that. And we went away and, you know, right, go away and do it, and came back 15, 20 minutes later, I've done it. And they're like, no, you've got the whole day on it. And I'm like, what do you mean we've got the whole day on it? Like literally the way my brain works, you give me a pen and a whiteboard, I am, you know, fried. You give me that task of like trying to visualize what a presentation of pictures looks like on a topic that I'm interested in. Yeah. I can put it together like that. And I was like, that was the first time I went, now I get it.
Yeah.
Now I get it. Yeah. The rest of my class who are, you know, a couple of the guys in my class, you know, like Paul and David, I mean, their writing is like poetry. You know, they could write assignments like, oh, it was just something I could never dream of. But like actually doing that sort of presentation, that's the sort of thing that fits well with a dyslexic brain. And so I said it was that really gave me the okay, this is it. This is
what. And what's the name of that again?
Oh, you'll never remember it. Like, don't worry about that. It's the it's called a Petacucha. I think it started in Japan, and it was this idea that most presentations are really boring because they kind of roll on.
If I ever see a PowerPoint, my brain instantly starts closing.
Switches off.
But you say about whiteboard, Tony Robbins, don't know if you've heard of him. Tony Robbins, I don't like to assume, but obviously most people have. He writes on whiteboards, and he said you can never read what he writes, and you can't. He uses it as like drawing what he's saying. I've started doing that, and I love it. It's like my
drawing what you're saying. Yeah, drawing what you're saying, I'll give you. But it's more like, you know, when you get those things, it's like, okay, guys, let's write the advantages and disadvantages of this new project, and like. I'm stood there going, how the hell do I spell advantages? I've not even got the bloody title of the slide before I've even started.
So I had something really embarrassing for the first time ever on the train the other day. First time for years. I've opened Evernote on my laptop, and for some odd reason it wasn't spell correcting, and it's a packed train, and I've got a person sitting right next to me, and I know he's looking at my screen, right. Nearly every word I wrote was spelt wrong. And I actually saw in the corner of my eyes, he was shaking his head. Like, and I was like, this is horrifying. Because normally I send something, it's all spell checked and it kind of works, and don't get me wrong, I get things wrong. but to actually feel the presence of someone next to you shaking their head at what you're doing. And I was like, well, anyway, I'll shut my laptop and put it away. I thought,
do you know the thing though, if you have to write on a board, is that what I do is I just try and make my handwriting so bad
that they can't read it. Yeah.
It's like, it's not about my spelling, it's it's my handwriting that's the problem.
Andrew, that is an amazing story about the fact that he writes so badly that no one can read what he's written.
Do you know what? We've just gone through it about me saying that, and I don't remember saying it, but I do it, and I learnt it actually from Tony Robbins, but not because Tony Robbins can't spell. He just says his expression when he writes on a board is just chaotic, but it just helps him get out. And I thought, I remember watching it and I was like, if I write like that, no one can criticize my spelling. So that's what I do. I've created my own shorthand.
Do you actually have your own shorthand? Or
yeah, I know what my shorthand is. I understand it. No one else will. It's not real shorthand. It's Andrew's shorthand.
Hi, everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life, and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergent, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
So going back to the podcast, you go on to talk about highlighting Branson or Einstein as dyslexic idols because it's kind of impossible as a standard to live up to. And I think that's a really interesting thing because those guys get referred to so often. And you also talk about what Edward's invisible gift is, as you do in every episode, which I'm keen to hear. But first, you asked Edward about his understanding of imposter syndrome and why women seem to suffer from it more than men.
So you mentioned in the blog and earlier about imposter syndrome. I wanted to speak to you about that because it's really interesting. In all the times I've ever spoken about imposter syndrome, it's always been with women. I've never spoken to a man about imposter syndrome, which I think is great because men obviously suffer from it as well. But men don't really talk about it as much. So for people listening, because not everyone knows what imposter syndrome is, what's imposter syndrome to you?
I think it's the feeling for me that you've got somewhere, you know, when you really shouldn't have done, you know, when really you're not clever enough, or you don't have the right attributes, or you don't have what it takes to be in that position, but people haven't quite realized it yet.
Yeah.
And that you're a bit of an imposter into the role or the job or team you're in. And at some point you're going to get found out, you know, at some point people are going to realize that, like, why did we give this guy a job? And I think it comes from a place where, you know, very early on, you know, you're categorized as being, you know, being just, it's a bit weird when you were younger, because I don't really remember exactly the moment I found out I was dyslexic, but I don't really remember the moment I knew that I was struggling. Does that make sense? Yeah. I don't remember struggling. I just remember everybody else telling me that I was struggling.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, really? Am I? And and I think it's from that very early age, you have this like self-consciousness that people have been telling you for your whole life that you're a bit of that you struggle and that things are a bit more difficult for you than others. And, you know, there was one of the podcasts that I was listening to that you did, and somebody said that, you know, it's quite hard being told you're different. And actually that was like, you know, emotional guy. So I was like, oh, choked me a little bit. I was like, yeah, that's how I felt. Like, people have always just characterized me a bit different. And therefore you do have this kind of natural thought of, well, at some point they're going to figure out that I shouldn't really be here, that I shouldn't be doing this.
I always worry about, people ask me about telling people I'm dyslexic. I will tell people in my company I'm dyslexic, but when I'm doing something new that I've never really done. So at the moment I've got, I'm talking to just people that run businesses, but willing to invest in my business to help it grow. And ironically, they know this podcast exists, but I'm very worried about telling them I'm dyslexic because I am definitely sure that that would affect things, that I'm dyslexic. So it's really, it is a real worry whenever I do something new to tell people.
I mean, the blog that I wrote was really cathartic. I mean, I've only had positive reactions from it pretty much. You know, and people, companies and CEOs where when I've made the investment, they've said to me afterwards, you know, I read your blog and it was awesome. And like, so I think it's probably, we think that is
a negative
and a bigger deal than it actually is. I mean, really, they just want somebody that can do what they need us to do.
But it makes sense when you say about imposter syndrome is because of all the people telling you before, because I've always I haven't experienced imposter syndrome. But my wife, who is so unbelievably talented in what she does, has had imposter syndrome in every single step in her career. She's like, should I go for this job? And I'm like, well, and she's like, this guy is going for it and he's nowhere near as good as I am, but he's so confident he's going to get it. And then they get to the thing, she's like, I always find it's to a point where most people with imposter syndrome know that they can do it, or they think they're good enough to do it. But the people that end up applying for the jobs or something like that, just going for it. It's like fake it till you make it sort of thing. And it's really two different schools of thought.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether that's a difficult one. I mean, you know, with just the whole way that society is built up around women and men. And from a very early age, you know, if you're a female with leadership qualities, you're called bossy. Yeah. You know, there's loads. I'm actually quite into this topic. I've got two girls. Yeah. And I don't, you know, I want to make sure that they don't kind of end up being hit by society in the same way. And Sheryl Sandberg, COO of Facebook, she wrote a really good book called Lean In. So if anyone, I think it's actually better. Personally, I think Lean In is better for men to read that are working with women or have got daughters or whatever, because I think you start to understand the psyche a bit more and what we can actually then do something about it. But I think it's a really difficult subject, because the way society is built, it doesn't matter what you say, it's built in a man's world, and that makes it really hard for women, you know.
Yeah, well, this is something I've got to think of, because my newborns, well, say newborn, 9 weeks old now, as a girl as well.
Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. It's an excellent book.
It becomes an audiobook.
It does. I absolutely listen to it on audiobook. I will listen to it. I mean, I would say to people that I listen to audiobooks rather than books because of time, which is partly true. Like, you know, I do a lot of traveling, and you know, when you're washing up and all this sort of stuff, you can just put the audiobook on. But also, I just enjoy it more.
I want to talk to you about, we briefly spoke earlier before the podcast about your blog and how you named it. And I want to speak because it feels like a big statement to put dyslexic investor. So how happy were you to put dyslexic investor as your name of kind of as the blog?
I mean, the honest truth is that I didn't think anyone was going to read it, so I didn't actually think, I hadn't actually thought that far ahead. Yeah. I was just like, it just sounded like a catchy title. If you're going to talk about, you know, if you're going to talk about dyslexia and the role that you do, that sounded like a catchy title. But I genuinely didn't think there'd be many people, and it was actually, the blog was cool because, like, for a very small window, and I'm talking about 3 days, 3 or 4 days, you know, I was like, I was coming into work going, I'm trending, guys. I'm absolutely trending. My entire self-worth was on how many likes I'd got that day on my blog and how many comments I'd got. You know, I completely got into all of that. And then the pandemic hit, and I was like, damn, coronavirus. Completely stopped me in my tracks. I think it's an interesting idea, though, as well, that I think, and you talked a bit about made by dyslexia. Is that what they're called? I can't remember. Made by dyslexia. And I think they do a great job, and it's definitely putting out there. I think one thing I slightly struggle with is that for dyslexics is that you also get this thing where, you know, you think about the people that are famous dyslexics, like Richard Branson and Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom and Einstein and stuff. And I'm like, Jesus, that is a higher bar.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, hey, don't worry about it. You're dyslexic. You could also be Einstein. Yeah. I'm like, oh, thanks. Well, thanks for that. I'm not particularly good at chemistry. And I sort of thought there was like, part of it was about going, actually, you can just be dyslexic and just do a normal job or a job that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think was right for dyslexia. You don't have to be Richard Branson to be a successful dyslexic.
Well, that's why I wanted to do this podcast, because there's still people doing amazing things who are dyslexic. But like you say, that bar is insane. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, you could be Richard Branson. He's a billionaire. Like, I think people easily just see billionaires.
So if you're a kid that's struggling at school and not going very well in their GCSEs, and it's like, don't worry, you could be Keira Knightley. It's like, I appreciate what they're doing, what celebrities are doing. And like, I'm not knocking it at all, because they're bringing it into the frame.
Yeah.
But it also becomes a really bloody high bar, doesn't it? It becomes this thing where you've kind of got a lot of, you seem to have a lot of creative people that are the faces, you know, it's like Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley and da da da. And you think, I'm not creative. I know there's this word creative that I have, and I know you've used it a lot on the podcast, where you say, what are good dyslexics good at? Well, they're good at being creative. Mm. And I think, I know what it means when you're saying it, but what sometimes I hear is, you know, my sister is an incredible makeup artist in the West End and on movies and all the rest of it. She is creative. My wife is a private chef, and trust me, she is like one of the most creative people I know. She's a, you know, an artist with what she does. Mm. I do spreadsheets. It's not that creative.
No.
And so again, if you use these kind of, you put these kind of people up in lights as the what you could be if you're a dyslexic, you could be a famous Hollywood actor.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, I'll just do something quite bland. Like the Dyslexic Investor sounded a bit, sort of maybe interesting if you're interested in dyslexia.
No, see,
but slightly bland in terms of kind of the role, the job.
But that, I think the thing that I loved about that title is it's so something you wouldn't expect from a dyslexic person. That's why I really liked it. I was like, oh, actually, that's great, because we do, you're right, and we have a lot of people that come on the podcast. We have such different spectrums that are either business owners or artists or actors and stuff like that, or comedians, and that's not, yeah, there's different forms.
Well, you've had,
of creativeness.
Yeah, you've had like, either, you know, listening to your podcast, the general people that come on do tend to be the like actors, and it's like, how do you get around your lines? Or they tend to be, as you say, you know, artists or whatever. And I just thought it'd be funny to put probably a name out there that was bloke that does spreadsheets. But I think that you then go, I know what you're saying for creativity. What it really means is, for a dyslexic, I think, is, you know, problem solving and visionary, seeing the big picture. It's that type of stuff, coming up with ideas.
Yeah, they're missing out on something really key. Dyslexic people generally react better with videos and stuff like that, because it's a different way of learning. We learn more kinesthetically than written. And I think it's funny, the charities that are there for dyslexic people are doing exactly the opposite of what dyslexic people would consume normally in their way of doing it.
I'd agree with that. And it's not to take a pop at anybody that's promoting the benefits. I say, and actually a friend of mine took a pop at me for that title, I think I said, Investor, which was that he said, well, why do you have to put the dyslexic investor? What's the relevance of being dyslexic and an investor?
Well, again, that comes back to, and I'm not harping about women, but it's a good example, is adding women in front of everything. When, like, Ronda Rousey famously said, I'm not a female UFC fighter, I'm a UFC fighter. That's not how I want to be known. And that's what, and again, I think that goes quite well with dyslexia. Why do you have to mention it? But the good thing is, though, it draws attention to what you do, and someone will read your blog and go, actually, I'd love to be an investor, and it shows that you can.
Yeah, I mean, that was the idea. It was just, the topic was, the blog was about my journey with dyslexia. So
what would you say your invisible gift is?
You know, more than anything, I would say it's the ability just to roll back from failing and not be too bothered about it. If I'm, you know, to try and, you know, always just try and do the best I can, you know, do the best job that I can. And if things go wrong, not let it dwell on me. And as we've talked about, like, whether that's dyslexia or whether that's just the cause of dyslexia, meaning that I failed a lot when I was younger and therefore it's not something that particularly scares me. I think that's probably it. I don't worry about failing, and like doing things like this podcast, you know, this is obviously a bit nerve wracking, but I don't, you know, challenge yourself, get in there. If it goes wrong, you know, what's the worst that can happen?
And I think that's always been from the start of what I said, my gift is really not worrying about what happens, because it can't be much worse. I said I famously gave 2 best man speeches in my life and never wrote them. I just went up and winged it.
I've given 2 best man speeches in my life as well. and I went for the Oscar in both of them. The first one I gave to, I was in America, and I gave it, it's like, you know, middle America sort of thing. And I gave it to an American audience. There was only about 30 people in the crowd. And obviously my British humour went down so well, about genuinely during my speech, 5 people walked out. Oh. And there was only sort of 30 in there. So if you ever want to film, you know, and I was like, just keep going. And then the other one was to 120 people in a British wedding, and that went down much, much better. Well, so yeah. that was all right. But again, you know, it's like, you know, it didn't ruin his wedding. You know, no. he's all right still.
My second try was much better as well. My first try, I famously mentioned his ex-girlfriend, which went down like a lead balloon. He now blames, they're divorced now, sadly, and he now blames me for it. He jokingly, we always joke about it, as she's remarried now. But I weren't his best man this time. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been great having you on here.
No, it's been a pleasure. It's been, it's been really enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, Andrew, that was a fantastic conversation with Edward. His invisible gift being the ability to roll back from failure and always try his best. It's a really interesting one. And this whole failure thing is something that has come up. I seem to say this at the end of every episode, but there are some recurring themes, and failure is one of them.
Well, if we go back to season one, actually, the whole of season one was about failure, and I think that's what comes out from it. But it seems to be people who get up to senior positions always say it's failure. Now, I don't think this is just a case for dyslexic people. I think it's a case for everyone, but it's certainly dyslexic people understand failure a lot more because we've done it so often when we're younger. But yeah, he really puts across that point really well.
What's your take on his thoughts around this presentation style, the Pecha Kucha Japanese PowerPoint presentation style where you show 20 slides for 20 seconds with commentary on each, and how that's so great for dyslexics?
Well, again, this comes back to something that's really interesting. So after we spoke about this, I looked into how the TikTok's working so well, and it actually mentions the two link quite well. It's our ability to focus on each film for a short period of time. And actually that's why platforms like LinkedIn and Instagram have come so big, and it's basically putting that version in a presentation.
So I guess that just leaves us to say thank you to Edward for coming on the show. You can learn more about Octopus Ventures on their website, octopusventures.com, and you can follow Edward, the dyslexic inventor, on his blog. On LinkedIn, just search for Edward Keelan. That's K-E-E-L-A-N. We will, of course, as we do every week, link everything in the show notes. Next week, Andrew, on the podcast, we have social media expert and personal branding guru, Ellie Middleton.
Yes, and we've just spoken about how Edwards has gone viral. Ellie's just done exactly the same, and it's just fresh.
I think I saw a post the other day of hers that she just crossed 1 million views on LinkedIn in under a year.
Unbelievable.
She's going to talk about her experience of going viral and share some tips, hopefully, on how you can build your own personal brand.
Yep, and I'm hoping very, very strongly that she's going to guide me in the right direction in that way.
I think that probably concludes today. I'm looking forward to this chat with Ellie. The conversation with Edward today was fascinating. That just leaves me to say, make sure you smash that like button, leave us a rating or review if you can. And Andrew, this has been The Invisible Gift. We'll see each other next week.
See you next week. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to The Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.